Good morning, everybody.
Very loud this morning.
Welcome to everybody. I hope everybody's well. This morning, we are, I think, going to have some fun. It's a very interesting sheet, I think, and a very interesting topic, which we started already last week, and I'm going to spend a couple of minutes just recapping what we did last week to bring you into this topic today. We're talking about Mechitza. And before I go any further, let me just mention there is a book here called The Sanctity of the Synagogue, which is quite an old book now. I'm not even sure it's still in print, but it's an excellent resource. I mentioned last week that there was a very famous case in 1955 in Mount Clemens in Michigan, where there was a court case in the Michigan Supreme Court about an Orthodox shul that wanted to get rid of its mechitza, and this book basically charts the battle in court there and how eventually the court ruled that they had to have a mechitza. Yes. Okay, we've run out of source sheets. If people could share just one between two, that would be very kind. And next week we'll just have to copy a few more. Okay, let me recap for you where we were last week. Last week we said the following. In part one, we said that we looked at three basic reasons why Mechitza was backed up in the classic sources. Even though, and we'll address this point today, please God, for some reason Mechitza is not explicitly mentioned in the places you'd expect it to. It doesn't say in the Shulchan Aruch, and when you go into Davin, you have to have a minyan and you have to have a Mechitza. It doesn't say that. Why does it not mention the Mechitza? We will talk a little bit about that question today. But we looked at three basic sources last week. Number one, in the Bet HaMikdash, there was a separation of sorts between men and women. On Sukkot, they had the women upstairs in the balcony and the men downstairs. The rest of the year, we saw last week, was not so clear exactly how things were separated, and the Ezrat Nashim, so-called, was definitely not a women's-only area in the Bet HaMikdash. That's clear. The Ezrat Nashim was usually a fairly mixed area, but there was some level of separation, and we saw, therefore, that the Mikdash Ma'at model, a Beth Knesset today is called a Mikdash Ma'at, and we saw a number of people, Rav Cook and others, who said that just like there was separation there, there has to be separation for the Kedusha of the Beth Knesset too. That was the first model. The second model we saw was in the concept of custom, of minhag. And not minhag in a kind of light sense, as I said, like my minhag is to have bagels and lox on Sunday morning kind of minhag, but minhag in the classic sense where the Rambam in Hilchas Mamrim says that just like the Sanhedrin introduced Gezerot and Takanot, which are underpinned by the two Torah mitzvahs of Lo Sasur and Ta'aseh, that you have to do what the rabbi says. So too, said the Rambam, there are things he calls minhagot, where they're brought in by the rabbis of the Sanhedrin and Chazal and accepted by Klal Yisrael as a whole. These, he says, have a binding nature. They are not just things that can be shifted and changed. They can only be changed in the way that other rabbinic laws can be changed. And he said, Mechitza, clearly Rav Cook also talks about this. Mechitza is one of those. And this base of Lo Sasur, as well as Shema Bani Musar Avicha, he talks about that. And we look in sheet one for more information on that. That was a very important point. And the third model we saw, where Rav Moshe Feinstein has a very important shuva, we saw that last week, we looked at quite a few bits of it, where he says there is a Torah proviso that men and women have to be separated. He says there at the end, maybe even in other public gatherings, but we're not going there because we had a shir on mixed seating at weddings and things like that. But certainly, he says in shul, he feels that there is a Torah mitzvah to have a mechitza. We saw Rav Soloveitchik said, no, he thinks there's a Torah mitzvah to have separation, and the rabbinic mitzvah to have a mechitza, but Rav Moshe says, no, there's a Torah mitzvah to have a mechitza. Where does he get that from? He gets that from the Gemara there in Sukkah that we looked at, where they learned the Pasuk in Zechariah, where Zechariah talks about in future when they give the hesped for Mashiach ben Yosef, and you remember we had a shir on Mashiach as well, we talked about this, there will be a separation of the men and the women, says Rav Moshe, but that's the Pasuk in Zechariah. How can I learn a Torah mitzvah from a verse in Zechariah? And he raised last week, and I mentioned this in passing, but I'll mention it again, a very fascinating halakhic point. He says sometimes there are verses in the Nevi'im which are not being introduced by the Nevi'im. They are actually evidence of a Torah Sheba'al Peh that comes before. Sometimes not. Meaning sometimes the Nevi'im bring in a new halakha. For example, also in Zechariah, the idea of fasting on Tisha B'Av. Everyone agrees that's a drabbanon, that's a rabbinic mitzvah, not on any level a Torah mitzvah. But he says, no, there are other things which actually are underpinned by Torah mitzvahs as well, and actually knowing, did the Nevi'im create this, or are they just recording this, is an interesting set, an interesting debate in terms of the halakhic process. That's what we talked about last week. Today, I want to look with you at three other models for why we need a mechitza, which will hopefully deal with the topic quite well. I want to look at the issue of whether men and women are meant to be seeing each other. Rav Moshe said very clearly last week, my problem, he says, is not with the men seeing the women. In the Beit HaMikdash, he says, the men could see the women. They were on a balcony. You could see women very clearly on a balcony. That was not the problem. The problem was mixing. We'll see today a whole other school of thought that says, no, mechitzas have to actually block out view. The men may not see the women at all. And we'll also talk about two other models, which is Chukas HaGoy and the nature of tefillah itself. But first, let's talk a little bit about synagogue architecture. When you look at shuls over the last 2,200 years, where is the Ezrat Nashim? So it depends. There are basically three models. An upstairs-downstairs model, okay? A separate women's section model, and also a separate women's shul model. There seems to be such a thing as a Bet Knesset LeNashim. And we'll see some evidence of this as well. And there were many shuls that just didn't have any provision for women at all. The Alt Neuschul, which we'll come to, which was built in the 1270s, did not have any provision for women. They had to add on a section and knock a few windows through so that women could see something. It came later. But let's have a look at this. I want to start with a source which I think is very, very illuminating. In the north, in the Galil, they find quite a lot of Bate Knesset, which have balconies. Okay? The question is, who sat in those balconies? And there is a difference of opinion amongst the academics, and I'm certainly not someone who has any background in this, but you can do your PhD thesis if you want on this topic. Mm-hmm. Did the women sit in the balconies, or did other people sit in the balconies? And I don't have a view on that. You'll find strong opinions one way or the other. We know they had balconies, but we don't know who sat there. But we do know how they sat in the Alexandria shul. Look in number one. This is a source in the Gemara in Yerushalmi, in Sukkah, where we actually brought this source previously. Remember we had a shir on hearing aids and microphones on Shabbat? And we brought the source there about the shul in Alexandria where they had to wave a flag because there were so many people in the shul that they couldn't actually hear where the brachas began and end, and therefore they waved the flag to show people when to say amen, and we used that for others. We'll see the same source from a different perspective. Look at number one. Tani, I'm a Rabbi Yehuda. So Rabbi Yehuda says the following. Kol shelo yira'a dipli istava. So the dipluson, the shul there, which was the double colonnaded shul in Alexandria, Shal Alexandria, lo yira'a covered Yisrael miyamav. If you never saw that shul, you never saw the glory of the Jewish people. This was a shul which was built, by the way, in the 3rd century, 4th century BCE, which was then destroyed, we'll see, by Trajan in 117. So look at how that shul was designed. First line, number one. Kamin basiliki gedola. It was like a great basilica. Now, we are used to thinking of basilica as a church thing. Actually, the church just adopted it later from Roman architecture. A basilica was a certain model with colonnades and usually a dome of some kind. There was a great, something that resembled a basilica. However, it's of litlim stuff, and there were two columns in front of other double colonnades. Loyai yoshvim urvavim. They didn't sit mixed. Now here it's not talking about women and men. Elo yoshvin kol umnus v'umnus. Every single trade, bisnei atzmah, sat by itself. The tailors together, the doctors together, the lawyers, I don't know where they call the lawyers, probably somewhere way away, but everybody sat together. She'im yabo achsanai. So if someone came visiting from out of town, yehei mudbak v'dnei umnato. He would immediately find his own trade, his own guild. Umisham haito paranasato yosat. And then he could actually have paranossa if you are very fit. We should try this, don't you think? We should try this in our shuls, just separate them all by what people do. Okay? So, very nice. The Gemara goes on to say, Shumichriba. So how was that shul eventually destroyed? I would say, Trajanus Harosha. So Trajan. Trajan actually destroyed that shul. What did he do? He kifan legionot. He surrounded it by the legions. The Hargan, and he slaughtered the people. It was a very tragic end to the shul, because the shul was actually destroyed during the revolt. The Bar Kokhba revolt in Israel was accompanied by other revolts all around the Jewish world. And in Alexandria, the Jews revolted against the Romans, and the Romans clamped down and destroyed the shore. Amal and Eshehem, his Trajan said to the women, Nishmaz atem legionatai, give yourself up to my legions. Obviously, that they will do with the women as they please. Ve'ein ani horegetchem, and then I will save your lives. Look how the women responded according to this Gemara. Amrin later, they said to him, Mada avadat ba'arei, what you did on the ground floor, avid be'iloi, now you have to do on the upper floor as well. Irei daman, and then he killed the women who were where? On the upper floor. Irei daman ba'daman, and the blood of the men and the blood of the women never mixed together, v'halach adam ba'yam ad Kipris, ad Cyprus. So the blood flowed out into the sea. Probably this is somewhat of an exaggeration for Cyprus, but he means that the Mediterranean ran red with the blood of the Jews who were slaughtered there. But what you see from there, interestingly, is that at least the Gemara understood that the shul in Alexandria had men downstairs and women upstairs, which is an interesting perspective. And in fact, if you look through, I brought you a few sources from the medieval period. Again, we don't know exactly what the status was of the synagogues that we get to see in the Galil from the Byzantine period, but the Maharil, who was living in Europe in the 15th century, talks about making machitzas between the men and the women in shul, dividing the men and the women in shul. If you look on page 2 on the top, the Mordechai who was living in Germany in the 12th century, at the same time as the Rosh and the Maram of Rodenburg here, he's looking number 2. As al mechitza she'oseh l'tzniut, can you make a mechitza on Shabbat? He wants to know. Now, you can't normally make a partition on Shabbat because it creates a new actual area, halachic area, and you cannot create that, the binyan on Shabbat. He says, a mechitza for tzniut ba'alma, just for dividing the men and the women, muta, you could do that on Shabbat. Kugon, for example, mechitza she'oseh b'shach adrosha. If the women come in for the drosha, I don't know, in some shuls the women leave during the drosha, but in some shuls they come in during the drosha. If the women come in for the drosha, bein anashim lenashim, between the men and the women, mutar lasasa b'Shabbat. You can do that on Shabbat. Interestingly, not only from the halachic point in Hilchot Shabbat, you can put them a pizza there, clearly there was a minhag there that they divide the men and the women at least for the drasha, and I would have thought that they probably weren't there for the service, but they came specifically for the drasha. You see number 3, look at this interesting source, brought by the Haggadot Maimonides. The Haggadot Maimonides is Rav Meir of Rottenburg, and his Rebbe is the Maharam of Rottenburg, famous Rav, the Rav of the Rosh, etc. He says, look at number 3, V'noigim b'nei Adam. What did people used to do on Kol Nidre night in medieval Germany? They had a minhag, lishan b'beit haKnesset, they would go to sleep in shul. What's the point of going home? What's there to go home for? Dinner? So they would sleep overnight in shul. Lefisha omrim, roch halayla, mizmorim, shirova, tushpachot. Because they would sing Tehillim and songs. Don't forget, Yom Kippur's a happy day. So they would sit in shul singing all Yom Kippur night. V'chein nag ma'aram, and the ma'aram of Rottenberg did the same thing. Amnan b'ma'arav rachot v'makom atfila, but he used to sleep in the western side of the shul, far from where they would be davening, hayayashan, or b'bet haKnesset shel anashim. Or he'd sleep in the women's shul. Because there were no women there. Because the women didn't stay the night. So what do you mean they would sleep in the women's shul? Maybe the women's shul was just the partition with the Ezra and Hashem. Maybe not. It doesn't sound like that from the next source. The Maharil was just 100 or so years later in the same place. He brings an actual tshuva here of a question of the women who light candles in the women's shul on Friday night. And they want to know, is that the right place to light candles, and they're going to have dinner there, and they're going to drink wine there? How does that work? So look what the Maharil says, number 4. Aval be'ed ve'irecha. In your town, he's saying to the questioner, Shebet haKnesset shel nashim, where was the women's shul? Hu b'marteifo shel hashamash. It was in the shamash's wine cellar. Interesting. Get a little vignette into life here. The shamash of the shul had a wine cellar. So they said, okay, we'll make that into the women's shul. The women will daven in the wine cellar. Maybe a good place to daven for the wine, I don't know. Shema chashim l'tarech suda, that's good enough. That women's shul for the purposes of the meal, if you like to, if they're going to go down there and get wine and eat there, etc. That's called part of the suda, l'mshoch yayin b'layla. V'kal shekeni madlikim b'beit haKnesset shel anashim etzel hayayin. All the more so if they light candles down there in the women's shul. So you see from this, I just brought that to you, to show you that it sounds like they had women's shuls in actually completely different buildings than the men's shuls. The penultimate shiloh of the Trumat HaDeshen, we've had the Trumat HaDeshen many times in this year, he wrote 354 Shilas, and we actually had the first one a while ago, but this is the penultimate one. He has the following question. Leah v'Rachel, cholkim. Leah and Rachel are arguing. Bishvil mekomot v'bet hakneset shal nashim, because they're arguing over seats in the women's shul. It's not just the men that argue. The women also argue. Behevi aleya shtei nashim, and Leah brings two women as witnesses, shema hakomot shelahi, that the places belong to her. V'Rachel hevia ish, but Rachel brings a man, echad, one man. Meir, and he gives testimony, shema hakomot shelahi, that no, the places belong to her. Eze ezut adifat ve, which testimony is more persuasive, he says, shtei nashim, two women, or shall ish echad, or one man, which I'm not getting into, because I want to get out of here with my life intact. But nevertheless, you see from here that there was a Bet Knesset Shel Nashim, there was a women's shul, and there was here a debate about, a dispute about where the seats were. So I don't know exactly where the women's shul was in many shuls. I brought you number six, something about the Altnoy shul, where they, as I said, they did not have any women's davening place there, but then they built an annex in the 14th century, and if you've ever been to the Altnoy shul to daven there, it's very difficult, the women can't really see very much, there's a little few little windows, it's like a barracks, okay, it was very much separated. And therefore, historically, there is no evidence that I'm aware of that men and women ever davened together in shul, and on the contrary, the evidence seems to be that they were quite hermetically separated in many ways. And in fact, even though Rav Moshe said that it doesn't matter if the men can see the women, not everybody agreed. So let's go on to that reason now. This is a fourth model for Mechitza. So 7 and 8 I brought you on last week's sheet as well. These were two sources in the Rambam and Mishnah Torah that says very clearly that men and women were separated on Sukkot in the Bet Mikdash, and underlined at the end of 7, why? Kedei shelo yitarvu elu im elu. He says very clearly that they will not mingle. And so too in the Hilchos Beis HaBechira, he says in number 8 at the end, Kedei shelo yiyu mu'urvavim, so they wouldn't be mixed up. However, the Rambam elsewhere, go over the page to page 3, on the Peirush HaMishnah says something very different. And this is going to take us in a different direction, which I think is a fascinating question. Number 9, Tikkun Gadol, Kolomar, Gadol HaToelet, why was it called a Tikkun Gadol? Because it had a great effect, it was very, very effective and important in redesigning the shul, in the Beit HaMikdash, rather. V'hu sheyu mechini makom l'nashim, they will prepare a place for the women, u'makom gadur l'anashim, and a fenced-off place for the men. Now that's very interesting, it's the men who were fenced in. Makom gadur la'anashim. That sounds like the men were more enclosed. Umakom anashim lamala. The women whose place was above. Ala makom anashim. All over the place of the men. Gvor memenu, and much higher than it. Why? Kedei shelo yistaklu ha'anashim b'anashim. So the men would not stare at the women. Now that's not what the Rambam said before. The Rambam in Mishnah Torah said the problem was mingling. Here he seems to have a much more fundamental problem, which is men and women, when they're together, the men behave badly. Meaning, Rav Moshe's reasoning, based on the other sources in the Rambam, was not about a sexual tension. It was about an atmosphere of frivolity. When men and women are together, it's a social, it's a kiddish, people are not focused, there's kalut rosh. Here, the Rambam is talking about something much more specific, which is hisaklut, which is inappropriate sexual thoughts on the part of the men. And in fact, the Meiri even goes to suggest that the balcony in the Beit HaMikdash actually had a trellis, some kind of a lattice network there. Look at number 10. The Kifua Kipsutzera, says the Meiri, from the Middle Ages here, he says they put a balcony up in the Beit HaMikdash. V'hi mechitza ke'ein svacha. It's a mechitza of some kind of a svacha. I didn't know what a svacha meant. I looked it up. It's a lattice or a net of some kind. And the women were there. So it sounds like, from some sources, it wasn't just there was a balcony. I remember the shul that I grew up in. The women had a big balcony, and you could sit on the men's side and view the entire women's section from the back. From the Meiri, it doesn't sound like that. And the Tosfos Yom Tov picks that up and takes it to quite an extreme place. Look at number 11. He quotes the Rambam. The Hadin Imo, that is the Rambam's din, and I think he's right, says the Tosfos Yom Tov. Tosfos Yom Tov is living in the 18th century in Poland.
Ki ha'anashim shelamata hayu haroim b'simcha.
The men downstairs would see the simcha. The loy ha'smechim atzma. The men had limited view. It's very interesting. The women had a clear view from upstairs. The men couldn't see very much. Because that was the whole point, was to kind of get the men pushed in the corner. You don't need to, what do you need to see? You can hear the simcha, that's good enough.
Va'amnam histaklut anashim b'nashim may be lidei kalat rosh.
And it's the staring of the men at the women that will lead to kalat rosh. And here he quotes the pasuk. Ki hu yimshal bach.
And now we get into sexual politics. Because he quotes the pasuk here from Adam and Chava. Men try to dominate women. That's what they do. Hu yimshal bach. Men take a proactive role when it comes to women.
Va'od mishum kishul adav. And the men will become actually aroused. V'shema yirakari. And they may be aroused to an extreme degree.
This is very extreme. Is that really going to happen? Says, yeah, you never know. You never know with men.
V'kol shekein b'chatzrot beit Hashem.
And all the more so when it comes to the Beit HaMikdash, meaning it's bad enough that would happen at the Chasna. But in the Beit HaMikdash,
this is not just about mingling. This is about open sexuality. And the question is that how we view interactions between men and women? Are men and women always, by definition, whenever they connect with each other, there's always a real concern of a sexual, or is that over-sexualizing the situation? And I want to bring you a few sources that deal with that, which I think comes up in this.
Certainly the Chasam Sofer understood, and now you'll understand why shuls look like they do today in many places.
The Chasam Sofer in Hungary understood very clearly. Number 12, Hatam Lezeh. Why do we have a mechitza? Ki anu ma'amin in shekol tfilah or shevach any tfilah, public prayer, hoda'ah, or public thanks, shemitarev v'machshava hahi, which is mixed, where the thoughts and the prayer and the feelings, the thoughts of the prayer are mixed with shum hirur, with any inappropriate sexual thought. Afilu be'ishto, even about your wife, lo tale b'ma lo tifnei Hashem yisbarach.
They won't, the prayers won't work. The prayers have been sullied. They've been flawed.
V'lo tikuban lefanav.
And those prayers will not be heard. I mean, again, how rabbis know which prayers are heard and which prayers, that's a good question. But he feels very strongly that if there's any inappropriate sexual thoughts amongst the men, that the tefillah won't work.
That's why we have a mechitza.
So they take knesset, mitnei asma.
Shelo yavol lidei hirhur. So the men won't think inappropriate thoughts for b'shas tefillah. I suppose that the women also might not thought, but here the focus is more on the men. But take tefillah, nidchit v'achmana litzlan, and God forbid the prayer will be rejected. V'yetelanu ma misimchat beta, and we get this.
This is why balconies have curtains. This is why you go to some shuls and there is a floor to ceiling, mechitza. Sometimes the women are in a room at the back with a little window, or a room on the top with a little hole in the floor. The main purpose of the mechitza, as the Chasam Sofer is, the men must not be allowed to look at the women. And Rabbi Dr. Norman Lam, in the first edition of Tradition Journal, in 1959, which came just after the Michigan case of the Mechitza, he chose to write an article on what he calls separate pews in the synagogue, a social and psychological approach, where he doesn't go through the halachic sources, but he talks about the sociology of Mechitza. And I want to bring a conversation between Rabbi Lam and Rabbi Moshe Lichtenstein, who wrote his piece 50 years later. They didn't have this conversation with each other, but their writings speak to each other. Have a look here at number 13. Says Rabbi Lam, and by the way, you'll get a feel for how the styles of writing are very different in the 1950s than today. It's actually very interesting. This whole book, by the way, is a fascinating window on life in the 1950s, 60s, and 70s, and you realize quite how much has changed since then. When I think of the 1970s, it doesn't feel that long ago to me. Some of you here probably even less long ago, but I can assure you it was a long time ago. My daughter, when she talks about the 1980s, in her mind that means the 1380s.
Yeah.
You know, she says that's from the 1980s.
Yeah.
You know, whatever. Number 13. As long as men will be men, and women will be women, there is nothing more distracting in prayer than mixed company. It is too much to expect of a man sitting in feminine company to concentrate fully on the sacred words of the siddur and to submit completely to God. We are speaking of the deepest recesses of the human heart. It is there the prayer originates. And how can one expect a man's heart to be with God when his eyes are attracted elsewhere? We are speaking of human beings, not angels, and the halacha recognizes both the strengths and weaknesses of a man. It is simply too much to ask of a man that he sit in the company of women, that he behold their loveliness, and at the same time undergo a great religious experience. What man can feel the nearness to God when, if he but raise his eyes from the corner of the sitter, he finds himself attracted to more earthly pursuits, which do not exactly encourage his utter devotion to the pursuit of godliness? And what woman can concentrate on the ultimate issues of life and feel the presence of God when she is far more interested in exhibiting a new dress or a new chapeau? Okay. Again, I don't think you can get away with this today in the same way, but I remember lots of fancy hats in shawl, and don't tell me you don't remember that. Lots of fancy hats in shawl. How can she try to attract the attention of God when she may be trying much harder to attract the attention of some men? When the sexes are separated, the chances for such distraction are greatly reduced. And then he talks about the general mingling issue. But clearly he's saying there that it's a distraction because of the staring and the looking. Rav Moshe Lichtenstein, go over the page. Now, I don't know if Rav Moshe has ever spoken to Rabbi Lam. Rabbi Lam is living in New York still. Admeva Eshem Shana, Rav Moshe Lichtenstein is here in Eretz Israel. But Rav Moshe wrote a piece on Kol Isha, which we looked at when we saw the Shir on Kol Isha. And one of the paragraphs there says that he feels that there's been an overemphasis on the sexualization of every interaction between men and women. Look what he says. He says it very nicely. Number 14, the reasoning of some poskim that every person experiences sexual thoughts in every situation assumes that relations between people are at all times and in all instances of a biological natural character. It assumes that a man is incapable of seeing a woman or hearing her voice without perceiving her as an object. True, Chazal counts sinful thoughts as a transgression which no man can escape even for a single day, that's what they say. And there is no doubt that the sexual urge is one of the most powerful and primal within man. However, that is not to say that man is unable to escape sinful thoughts at every hour of every day. Just as halakha takes care to preserve the boundaries of modesty, it is also careful not to present man as a creature exclusively driven by urges. And halakhic authorities should take caution against charging every encounter between a man and a woman with sexual tension. And he expresses this in other ways when he talks about the difference between a man-woman connection and a male-female connection. He says sometimes in society, in the Orthodox world regards every connection as a male-female connection, and it has sexual connotations. To the point when carried to the extreme, this is why we end up erasing the faces of young girls from photographs and from adverts, etc., etc., because you can't have any image of any woman anywhere because the assumption is that the interaction will be male-female. The secular world goes to the opposite extreme and assumes that anybody will have a arm's length man-woman connection, no matter what the context is and no matter how people are dressed and how people are acting, and they have to be able to keep that distance. And the question is that naive? Is that just a thin veneer for what is actually a deeply sexualized society? And like everything in life, you know, Rav Nachman had it right. It's a geshet tzar ma'od. You know, it's finding that balance between these two extremes. And Rav Moshe is just making us aware that sometimes in the Jewish world that we have today, we're extremely overcautious and maybe pessimistic. Maybe other people are over-optimistic. But this is a balance which we have to get right. And it's not clear where it is. Rabbi Lam actually preempts this argument back in 1959. And look at number 15. He says, this argument where he says men and women should be separated because they look at each other has often been objected to on the grounds that it takes an unrealistic and exaggerated view of man's erotic responsiveness, and that certainly devout Jews who come to pray should not be suspected of romantic daydreaming. That such objections can be raised seriously in our present post-Freudian culture and society is unthinkable. Meaning, how can you say, like Rav Moshe Lichtenstein said, that you can have an arm's length non-sexual? You can't. Everything is sexualized. Evidently, our sages who lived in a society of much greater moral restraint had a keener and more realistic insight into psychology than many of us moderns in our sophisticated society, where the most grievous moral offense is no longer regarded as particularly shocking. Exactly what the most grievous moral offense was in 1959 is an interesting question, and how that would compare as to what's going on in 2018-19, that's an interesting question. And then, quite unexpectedly, he starts quoting from McKinsey reports. The late Dr. Kinsey's works prove that the intuitive insights of the Jewish sages are confirmed by modern statistics and sexological theory, which is the last thing you'd expect in an article in tradition journal. But he then goes into an analysis of the Kinsey reports, which, don't forget, in the mid-50s were quite new. For those of you who don't know what the Kinsey reports are, you're obviously too young, and that's fine. You can look it up on Google, but maybe not. So you have a very important debate here, which we're still having. And today comes into the, didn't you put women's pictures on websites and this and that, in terms of advertising perfectly innocent things or not. And there is this back and forth in this way. Now, one thing is for sure, men have to be very careful at how they view women. But the question is, does that make it the woman's responsibility to take account of the man's weakness? And that's an interesting question. Look in this source from the Mishnah Berurah. The Mishnah Berurah here, number 16, deals with this issue of histaklut. And it says, Le'inin iso histaklut. When it comes to men's inappropriate viewing, the kula alma am histakel be'isha. And he quotes the Gemara. Everyone agrees if a man were to look at a woman, afilu be'etzba katana. And this is the phrase he uses in the Gemara. Even in a little finger, which is the least sexual part you could possibly think of looking at. Kevanshin is takelba. Since the man is staring appropriately, he's not talking about looking normally, staring inappropriately, lehanov, in order to get benefit from that. Over balav. This is breaking a Torah mitzvah. The lot aturu achrei nechem. We say this every day in Shema. Don't be drifting after your eyes. The amru, and they say that, he says, she quotes, she'afilu yesh b'yadu Torah masim tovim. Even if this man has Torah, he has good deeds. Lo yenakem idina shal gehenim. Okay, it's quite serious business, that's a tshuva, and this is a challenge, no question for many people. But we never ask women to cover up their little fingers just in case there's a man who is mistaken, that's what's going on, which is an important point. There comes a point that's not her problem anymore, that's his problem. And where exactly you draw that line is an interesting question. And of course, these different reasons for mechitza paint a different picture of mechitza. If you're talking about, we don't want mingling because of frivolity and the wrong kind of atmosphere, then the onus is on both sides. It's addressed at the men, it's addressed at the women. You can't have mingling. If you're saying, well, the reason we need a mechitza is because we don't want the men to look at the women, then now you've painted the women as really kind of, quote, part of the problem, unquote, which is a very different kind of debate in mechitza than the other approaches. And now it's not just about a onus on both sides, it's much more about what are we going to do to protect the men, which understandably many women feel, well, is that my responsibility, and how far is that my responsibility? There's no question that see-through mechitzas were very much opposed. Rav Volzner writes in number 17, I'm not reading the whole source, he was asked about an opaque glass mechitza, where you can see the women through the glass, but not clearly. He says, I don't understand why you'd even think that was mutter. How can that possibly be allowed? You can see the women. If you can see, you can see. Look at number 18. The Tzitz Eliezer records, V'hine she'elat ha-machitza. The question of machitza, kfar nit'ayra b'dor ha-kodim, has already been dealt with in the previous generation. But Sefer Leib Ivri, he quotes this book that was brought out in the 1800s, nitva p'sak din, they published a din there, a p'sak, al-kach asher alav chatumim l'ma'ala m'shiv'im gonit go'onim. 70 of the greats of rabbinic life in Europe in the 1800s, signed this psak. Ubaroshan Maharam Esh, the Maharam Esh was Rav Meir Eisenstatter, who was a rov in Hungary in the 1830s, 40s, less well known. But then Rav Shlomo Gansfried, which is much better known, who wrote the Kitzur Shulchan Aruch, what did they say? V'zeh l'shono, this is what the psak said. Asur la'asot mechitza hamavdelet bein ezrat nashim va'anashim. You are not allowed to make a mechitza between the men and the women in shul. Rek ba'ofen asher lo yuchal l'istakel anashim v'anashim. It must be in a way which is completely seals off the Ezra Nashim so the men cannot see. You have to do things like they used to be done. And if you made a machita like this, you may not go into that shul. That shul is off limits. You may not daven in a shul that has machita such that women can be seen. Now, if you pick this up in number 19, the Sridei Eish, who was Rav Yaakov Weinberg, who is already in the beginning of the 20th century, who was born in Eastern Europe but came to Central Europe and Germany, he writes something very interesting. You can see already a new perspective. Look at this perspective of number 19. The Sridei Eish writes as follows. Amnam Rabbanei Ungarn, the Rabbanim of Hungary, Machmiri Ma'od, are very Machmir. I mean, generally, they were very Machmir, which is one reason why the Kitzur Shulchan Aruch which ironically, when I was growing up, was the book usually translated in English that was on most people's shelves, even people who were not so religious had a copy of the Kids, which is a book which in many ways we actually don't pass him like La Halacha LaMaisa on many issues, because on some issues, because it took a very machmir approach, machmir ma'od, v'dorshim, and they require she'amachite tiyeg vo'ala mali mirosh anashim, has to be over the heads of the women. V'od marchikim lelechet v'dorshim shebaim ein bebeit ha'knesset mechitza, that they say also that if there is no mechitza, proper mechitza bebeit ha'knesset, asur lehitpalel sham. We just saw that set. V'asur lelashim lavo, women may not even go, or lehitpalel, or musav shiisharu bebeit ha'en. Better the women should stay home. How can you go to a shul where the men can see you? You should daven at home. Says the Sri Esh, v'adai shekavanatam letoba. I have no doubt that their intentions were only for the good. They're trying to repair breaches in the Jewish people and do the right thing. Nishmol ala tzniut, to trying to preserve tzniut, kifisha haita anahege bedorat hakodmim, like they used to be in previous generations. Aval, look what he says now. Bizmaneinu nishtane amatzav, but it doesn't work that way anymore. This is the 20th century. It's not the 12th century in the Alt Neuschul. V'nishtanu hativim, and people don't work the same way anymore. The hanashim, and when it comes to women, in tishar number bayit, if you tell the women to stay home, the lot of on lebet knesset, and to not come to shul, tishkacha mehem torat hayadut legamri, that will alienate them from the community, and they will not feel the sense of connection which will bring them into Judaism. Ubevaydot v'daisha asur lahadicham. One thing is for sure, you may not push away women from Jewish life. Ulaharchikem biglal chumra, because of a chumra yisera, what he calls an excessive stringency, she'ein lanu yisod mutzak b'shata poiskim. He says, yes, you need a mechitza, but you need a mechitza that makes the women invisible? That's not so clear. That's a chumra, what he calls a chumra yisera in shata poiskim, an excessive chumra. For that, you're going to push off half of Klal Yisrael, tell them to stay home? Now, you see other sensitivities coming in here. It's not just about what you can see and what you can't see. It's about the effect that the mechitza has psychologically on the communities. People can get very upset and engaged on the issue of mechitzas. And the Sri Aish says that is a relevant factor, which is not to be belittled. So, do you need to have a curtain on the mechitza? Depends who you ask. We saw Rav Moshe Feinstein generally said, you do not. However, it's not so straightforward. Because there's a second problem, which is, let's say you have a beautiful glass mechitza, but you can see through. So Rav Moshe will say, yes, no problem, that's a good mechitza. You don't need to stop people seeing through. But what happens if people are not dressed appropriately in shul? We never even raised that possibility yet. So Rav Moshe said, in the Beit HaMikdash, my assumption, says Rav Moshe, is that people were dressed appropriately. We can't know, we haven't got a time machine, but let's assume but in shul, is everybody always dressed in every shul appropriately for how you're meant to dress anywhere, let alone in shul? And the answer is, you know and I know that that's not always the case. And therefore Rav Moshe raises another issue in number 21, let's skip 20 for now. He says, V'dava mechitza sha'asa chelik mimenu bitchuchit. What about if you have the top half of the mechitza made of glass? Be'erech shlish milamala. A third of them. Now, how high did Rav Moshe say the mechitza had to be in last week's shiur? Does anyone remember? 18 tefachim. Around 60 inches. Says Rav Moshe, you could have the top third made of glass. No problem. Hine yafe katav. You've written quite correctly, the questioner. Shemidina mechitza lekechisaron. There's no problem when it comes to the technical din of mechitza. That's fine. I don't mind. It's high enough. Separates the people. You can't just pass things over. No problem. But I want to tell you something else, as Rav Moshe. Women might go there dressed inappropriately for shul. Shinira basaran, and you'll be able to see them, part of them you're not meant to see. Okay, like in America, he's talking in the 50s, 60s, people walk around in America dressed in all sorts of ways. And there's a completely different question here, which is, leave aside the issue of histaklut, and the men shouldn't be looking, etc., because of sexual reasons. Nothing to do with sexual. You are not allowed, a man is not allowed to daven if he's looking at a person who is not dressed properly. Now, there are different dinim, how are men meant to be dressed, how are women meant to be dressed, and there are even opinions, I skip number 20, but the Ramah seems to bring down, that even women are not allowed to daven when facing other women who are not dressed appropriately. Now, we don't pass in that way, And that's why you'll see women on the bus, you know, in Yerushalayim, whatever, saying Tehillim, irrespective of what other people are dressed like. But for sure, when it comes to men, there is a separate halachic prohibition. Even if a man would be completely unmoved by the sight, even if the man will, God forbid, blind. It's not about what he's looking at, it's about the fact that he is facing people who are not dressed properly, says Rav Moshe. That's a real problem. That's a real problem. The inkeni asulim mitpalelim kishef neim the tzadis rav nashim mitpalel b'loimed dibrei Torah. And therefore, he says you have to know your customers. If the women are not going to come to shul dressed appropriately, then yes, I think the glass machit is good enough in theory, but not in practice, because then people are looking at all sorts of things they shouldn't be. And at the end, I'll mention a few other things about machitas and different types and how they work in different places. Rav Riskin has a very interesting piece in this book about how they designed the machitza in Lincoln Square Synagogue. Many of you will have been to Lincoln Square Synagogue, and it had a very famous machitza in the old shul. It has also in the new shul a similar machitza, but he talks a bit about it. I'll mention it at the end as well. So that's one reason, that's the end of that reason in terms of what people are looking at. Let's go on to another reason, which is that tefillah should be a lonely experience. And this is something that people have not focused on so much. Says Rabbi Lam, a Jew approaches God, 22, out of solitude and insecurity, relying completely on him for his very breath. This complete concentration on God, this awareness only of him and nothing or no one else is called Kavanah. Without Kavanah, prayer becomes just a senseless repetition of words. The approach of the Jew to God must be out of a sense of isolation, of insecurity, of defenselessness. There must be a recognition that without God, none of us has any security at all. That my husband's life is dependent on God's will, his strength on God's favor, his help on God's goodness. And he's reflecting his own Rav Soloveitchik, who writes here as well in number 23, the entire concept of, quote, family pews, unquote, is in contradiction to the Jewish spirit of prayer. Prayer means communion with the master of the world, withdrawal from all and everything. During prayer, man must feel alone, removed, isolated. He must then regard the Creator as an only friend, from whom alone he can hope for support and consolation. And he quotes the Pasuk from Psalms, there from Tehillim. Clearly the presence of women amongst men, or of men amongst women. It's nothing to do with the women and the men, qua women and men. It's about the fact that you're with your family, which evokes a certain frivolity in the group, either in spirit or in behavior, can contribute little to the sanctification or the deepening of religious feeling. Nor can it help instill the mood in which a man must be immersed when he would communicate with the Almighty. Minimach and Kratzicha Hashem, for out of the depths I called you, says the psalmist, such a state of being will not be realized amidst family pews. And I brought you a Shulchan Aruch in number 25, which many people are not aware of. This is not just about men and women. Says the Ramah, Asur la adam l'nashek banav haktanim. You are not allowed to kiss and hug your little children and grandchildren, bebet kneset, in a shul. Kidei l'gvor b'liboy, so that you can fix in your mind, she'ein ahava, there is no love in the shul, ka'ahavat ha'makom, except for love of God. Interesting halacha. I'm not aware of anybody who actually disagrees with this as a halacha. The one is not, I remember when my son was bar mitzvah, Rav David Miller, who was the head of Grutz, who was the Rav in Haranoth of our shul, he's very close to my son, he shook his hand in shul, and the minute they got out of shul, he gave him a big hug. And he said, I would have hugged you in shul, but I can't hug you in shul, because it's a shul, and you know, that's not a place for connecting with other people. Very interesting question. And then Rav Lam, in a what sounds much more contemporary approach, says in 24, just on the top of this page, when orthodoxy tells the modern woman not to worship at the side of her husband, in whom she so trusts, it reveals an appreciation of her spiritual competence. Torah tells her she need not rely on a strong, superior male. It tells her she is his spiritual equal and is as worthy of approaching God as by herself as he is. It reminds her that women are the daughters of God no less than men are his sons. Our father is no less disposed to the company of his daughters than that of his sons. It tells her to address God by herself. She both cannot and need not rely on anyone else. A bit of woman power going on at the end there by Rabbi Lam. But the point I think is very well made. Maybe we think of shuls too much as social events. And, you know, there's a hall at the back of the shul for the social, which is another shir, but the shul itself is not for the social. Let me just finish off, almost finish off, with, we've got 15 minutes to go, with another, a final reason why Mechitza has been brought in, which is Chukat Hagoy. And actually, one of the reasons that the Reform Movement brought in, we saw last time Rabbi Wise, Isaac Meir Wise, in the 1840s, 50s, he very much modeled his shul seating on church pew seating at the time. Family seating had been accepted within the church by the mid-1800s. The church used to divide up the men and the women as well. But already by the mid-1800s, the phrase came in, the family that prays together, stays together. And everybody knows that. It's like, you know, the strongest phrase. So that is a completely Christian idea. It's a Christian idea, and one is not allowed to copy the Christian modes of worship. There's a pasuk in the Torah, 27. At the end of the pasuk says, "V'chukoteim lo telechu," you may not follow the ways of the non-Jews. And the Shulchan Aruch gives a specific example of shul design. Ein holchin, 28. Ein holchin v'chukat ha'odei kachavim. The line of damim land, you can't copy them, you can't follow their ways. V'lo yivne mekomot kebinyan hechalot sha'odei kachavim. Don't build your shuls like non-Jewish churches. To get lots of people in Kamosha Hemison like they do, which is very interesting because actually forget about Mechitza, if you look at some shul design, it's very church-like. You know, in England, if you go to the Italian shul in Rome, etc., many of the architects who designed these shuls were actually church architects, which is an interesting question. Is that right? Is that wrong? But leaving that aside, the idea of mixed seating was very much to copy the Christians, and I brought you another piece from Rabbi Lamb, where he basically, it's very interesting, he talks about the pagan roots of mixed prayer. This is something that we haven't talked about yet, but I want to mention now. Look at number 29. The whole idea of mixed seating in the synagogue is thoroughly objectionable, he says. It is an unambiguous case of religious mimicry. The alien model in this case is Christianity. Worse yet, the specifically pagan roots of Christianity. The position of the early church was against allowing its women to take part orderly in worship, and included a prohibition in praying in mixed company. The Corinthian church proved to be a channel for the introduction of pagan elements. And by the way, Rabbi Lamb, having just gone into an analysis of the Kinsey report, now goes into analysis of Paul's letter to the Corinthians in the New Testament. You get it all in that one article. Very, very interesting. I don't know if you could get away with writing that today, but that's a different thing. Because the Corinthians basically were pagan. Corinth itself was a city of pleasure, noted for its immorality, which usually had religious sanction. It was full of prostitutes, thousands of courtesans attached to the temple of Aphrodite. This pagan environment with its moral laxity had a profound effect on the Corinthian church. Over the page, the effort to introduce mixed seating and women's preaching is thus part of the pagan heritage of Christianity, just as Paul's initial efforts to resist these reforms were part of Christianity's Jewish heritage. It's very interesting. He plays out this whole idea of Jewish Christianity and pagan Christianity, which clearly there is a, you know, there are strong roots to that. And he says the Jewish Christianity was Paul speaking against mixed seating in Corinthians, and the pagan Christianity was the pagan cult and the ecstatic prayer. And we know that in the pagan world there was a lot of sexualization to worship, and that's presumably one of the reasons why Chazal was so clear that they wanted the men and the women separated, the Sanhedrin, on Sukkot, because you can just imagine on Sukkot with all the excitement, it could easily morph into something much more pagan and much less wholesome in that sense. And therefore, says Rabbi Lamb here, number 30, mixed seating thus represents a desire by Jews to Christianize their synagogues by imitating the practices of contemporary Christian churches. And this kind of mimicry, as we pointed out, is a violation not just of a specific law of the Torah, but an offense against the whole spirit of the Torah. Reform in Europe didn't know of mixed seating. It was first introduced in America by Isaac Meir Wise when he borrowed a Baptist church for his reform services in Albany. And he found the mixed views of the church so to his liking that he decided to retain this feature for his temple. We saw last week it was actually an economic issue. They paid so much for the shul that they couldn't afford to rearrange the pews for Jewish style seating. They're like, you know, something you ever said that we'll leave it as it is, we'll have mixed seating. We thus have only one conclusion as far as this is concerned, that those who have favored family pews have unwittingly advanced the cause of the paganization and Christianization of our synagogues. Understanding that it is wrong to assimilate Jews, we are now witnessing an attempt to assimilate Judaism. So there's another model. Chukat Hagoy. So there are six reasons we've seen so far that Mechitza has a basis in Halacha. Number one, which is the idea of the copying the Beit HaMikdash, the Mikdash Ma'at model. Number two, the strength of minhag, of custom, of going through Klal Yisrael, which is through the ages, which has an underpinning of Loisos. And number three, Rav Moshe's point about not allowing mingling and frivolity in the shul, because that's not the correct atmosphere, and men and women should be separated, certainly in prayer. Number four, the idea of the men not looking at the women, which puts it much more on the men, or on the women to be responsible for the men. We talked about that. Number five, the idea, what was number five? The idea of loneliness, that's right. The idea that the tefillah should be a personal, private, not a family affair at all. There is no connection with family, even with children, with grandchildren in a Bet Knesset. And number six, the idea that the whole mixed pagan approach to worship is something antithetical to Jewish ideas and has been copied from the non-Jewish world. Now, lots of reasons why mechitza is an important mitzvah. In some ways, too many reasons. You know, on a certain level, he thinks she does protest too much, in a sense. Why is it not there? We wouldn't need to have this whole shir if it was a simple line in Shulchan Aruch. Shulchan Aruch says you need 10 adult males to make a minyan. So then he let it say in the next line, and of course, you need a mechitza between the men and the women. Why did it not say that? Now, I brought a few suggestions. I'm not sure I'm happy entirely with any of them, but this is what I've got for you. First of all, not everything is in the Shulchan Aruch. And the Shulchan Aruch never claimed to be the ultimate repository of all Jewish halakha. He said, I'm writing you a practical guide, and some things are there, and some things I left out. For example, the laws of Lashon Hara are not explicit in Shulchan Aruch. Does that mean that Rabbi Yosef Karo didn't feel that there was a problem of Lashon Hara? And of course not. He never claimed to include everything, so it's not a taina on him if he didn't include everything. Okay, that's a bit of an easy way out, because the Rambam did claim to include everything, and he also doesn't have a clear halacha on mechitza either. So that's one approach. A second approach could be, it simply wasn't a daily reality. Why would you even include a halacha of mechitza when, just like, why would you think of men and women being in shuls together? The women were in their own shuls, if they were there at all. Maybe that was just so irrelevant until fairly recent times, that he never thought of including it because he was just not on his radar screen. That's not so straightforward. Again, I'm not an academic, but Professor Avram Grossman wants to suggest that actually in the Middle Ages, a lot of women did come to shul. I don't know his research, and I've not read his whole work on this, but he wants to say women did come during the week as well, on Shabbos, so I'm not sure whether that is a good reason. A third reason, and I suspect this might be the best reason of all, is that he thinks he did cover it. Meaning, the Shulchan Aruch clearly rules in Ebene Ezer, in Chaf Aleph, that whenever men and women are together, there has to be separation. Hidrachet min anashim, ma'od, ma'od, he says. And therefore, why would he even think of writing in the halachas of the Bet Knesset that men and women have to be separate? Men and women always have to be separate, as far as he's concerned. It's a little bit like people ask, why did the Shulchan Aruch not write that you can't listen to music during the Omer? Well, the Shulchan Aruch wrote you can't listen to the music ever during the whole year because of Chorban Beis HaMikdash. And therefore, why would he write that you can't listen to music during the Omer? He wouldn't even think that you would listen to music any time other than the Simcha. We had a whole shir about that, if you recall. So, it could be that the Shulchan Aruch felt that it didn't need covering because it had been covered. And the fourth reason is an interesting Rambam in who asked the question, why did the Mishnah not deal with the halachas of tefillin and mezuzahs? It's not in the Mishnah, clearly. Did people not have tefillin and mezuzahs? Of course they did. Look at the Rambam in number 31. You see if you like this reason. About dini hatzitzis, about tefillin and mezuzahs. The dinim of tzitzis and tefillin and mezuzahs. V'sei da'afiyatam, and how to make them. The habrochas, haroyas lahem, and all the brochas on them. The chen adin mashaychim, and all of the dinim that surround this. Hari ha-mishnah lo kaval ha-mitzvot. Mitzvot elu dvarim yuchadim. He doesn't fix a specific place. There is no place, there is no Masechet Tzitzit, Masechet Tfilin. I mean, there is in the Masechet of Katanas, but in the Mishnah, there's no Masechet Tzitzit. Hakol Limet Kol HaMishpatayim, Mishpatayim. Why doesn't he include them? And he says, Vahatama Dava. I think, says the Rambam, the following. Ladati, in my opinion. He's guessing this, but he thinks. Bizman Chibo HaMishnah, when the Mishnah was written, Shein Hayud Varmu for Samim Ragilim Etzel HaMainim Yachidim. Everybody who so knew, was so familiar with these halachas, that they didn't need to be told about them because they were so clear. And therefore the Mishnah never thought to write that because he would never have assumed that people needed to be told that. Why doesn't the Mishnah include a sidur? This is how you daven. Doesn't do that. V'seda manu hashliach tzibah. Why doesn't the Mishnah do this as a Rambam? Machmas pisumo shal davar, because everybody knows how to daven. You don't need to tell me how to daven, everybody knows that. V'fishalo chibah says sidur elachah chibah seda dinim. He just gives the dinim of davening. So the Rambam wants to suggest some things are not there because they don't need to be there because everybody knows them. Is that the reason why Mechitza is not there? I don't know. There seems to be a lot of things in the Shulchan Aruch that I would have thought were also pretty well known. I mean, he needs to still say that you need 10 men to daven in a minyan, to make a minyan. If everybody knew how to Mechitza, why didn't everybody know that? I'm not sure. I'm not desperately convinced by that reason. And at the end of the day, I think it still remains a question why Mechitza is not there. But I don't think there's any question that they had Mechitzas. That seems to be very clear from everything we've seen. Let's look at the last page. In the last 5 minutes, let me give you some practical background on some of the issues, the heights, the materials, etc. So we saw, according to the Hungarian position, that you need to basically block out view of the women, then there's nothing to talk about. You need Mechitzot Shel Barzel. You need totally hermetically sealed. But according to the other opinion of Rav Moshe, where it's only about mingling, so where, how far does that go? So Rav Moshe rules, as I said, that glass machitzas are okay in principle, but problematic if people are not dressed properly, specifically the women. He was in favor of one-way glass, and that's clearly a good option. In different shuls, they have mesh of different kinds where the women can see clearly through or semi-clearly, but the men can't see the other way. So that's clearly an option. Rav Moshe was fine with that. Do you need curtains on balconies? Rav Moshe said again, well, no, you don't, unless people are not dressed properly, etc. We've made that point quite clear. Rav Moshe rules in, I brought you the sources here, on a machitza which was 50 inches high, which was a bit short for him, but the top 13 inches were lattice work. And he said, he's not entirely happy with that, because the top's very see-through, and etc., etc. And he suggests hanging a curtain over it, but he says you don't actually need it for sure. He generally wanted a machitza to be 60 inches high. He was asked the question of what happens, as in Lincoln Square Synagogue, where there is a raised dais from the floor, and the women already start 30 inches higher, and then they have a little machitza on top of that. So from the perspective of the women, the machitza is very, very short, almost like knee height. But from the perspective of the men, it's higher because the dais is already raised. So he wrote and he said, I don't like it, but I can't tell you it's osa. Okay? And actually, very interesting, in this book here, Rav Riskin talks about how he fought to get any machitza into Lincoln Square Synagogue. In the early days when they were davening in Lincoln Tower, in the 60s, when they started up the minyan, he says there was a big fight, can they have a machitza, can't they have a machitza? And he tells the whole story of the Rosh Hashanah and this and that. This was before my time, you know, literally, I was born in 1968. So, now you're trying to work out how old I am. Okay, fine. And he basically says that eventually he managed to persuade the honorary officers of the shul to make a machitza, like I just described, where the women's section is raised and there is a glass area a little bit higher. He writes, if I can just find here, at the end here, when they built the new synagogue, listen to what he writes at the end. I didn't put it on the sheet because I only saw it this morning. He writes, the Lincoln Square became the institution on the west side, which I think is not an exaggeration. There remains for me one last task before I move to Israel, he says. I was very anxious to have a machitza that would be acceptable to and in accordance with the rulings of Rav Moshe Feinstein, 60 inches in height. That took time, says Rav Riskin. Eventually, however, a design that I liked and I thought a majority of people would accept was developed, and the design included the machitza 60 inches high, with the upper half made of glass, etc., etc., and the machitza was installed a year before I settled in Israel. Very interesting. I brought you just the last thing. Rav Soloveitchik is reported in many places, and I brought you Rav Henkin reports clearly to have said that in Shafat Chas, a machitza can be 10 tfachim tall. Meaning Rav Soloveitchik wanted a machitza to be higher than this, but was prepared to accept 10 tfachim under in extremis, which could be quite a lot shorter than Rav Moshe, 40 inches or maybe even a bit shorter. I remember when I went to Oxford University, the machitza in Oxford was very, very marginal. Okay? Rav Moshe for sure would have been very unhappy. And I remember as Rabbonim used to come through and visit us, when they walked into Rotterdam and looked at the machitza, I just sort of gauged their reaction. I should have taken photographs. Because different people had different legs. Some Rabbonim did daven there, some Rabbonim didn't daven there, but many places, and Rav Henkin writes here about his grandfather, okay, who was asked to paskin on a school, I don't know exactly where the school was, where they had a shul in the school which was very b'di'eved, but the rav of the shul had the school had tried to increase the height but had not succeeded, and he passed in that the rav could daven there, etc. You can read that yourself, and therefore obviously there's a difference between extreme cases and cases which are more l'chadchila. And at the end, I just brought you some of the summarizing G, some of the challenges, the importance of involving everybody in the community, the temptation to make women in the community feel that they're welcome guests in the community. I don't think that that's acceptable in our day. Women shouldn't be made to feel welcome guests. They should be made to feel part of the community. And doing that in a way which is halakhically authentic, but with hashkafic integrity as well, is a challenge. It can be done, and in many communities it's done well. In some communities it's done badly. But it's something we can work on, and hopefully we'll have the wisdom to do that. Next week, Be'ezrat Hashem, will be shir number 100. I feel we should make a kiddush of some kind, but I'm not promising to bring the whiskey. But the next week we'll go on to a completely different topic, which I've kind of decided what it'll be, but not fully. So please God, we should have a successful week, and I'll see you there.